Hey everyone, and welcome back for another deep dive. You guys send in some really cool excerpts from Dr. Konkol's lectures on the Book of Chronicles.
Yeah.
And I got to say, biblical genealogies don't usually scream excitement.
Right.
But this one is different.
Oh, yeah.
We're not just tracing names and dates here.
Mm-hmm.
We're uncovering how power dynamics played out, you know, back in ancient Israel. And how David actually built his kingdom.
It's so fascinating how the chronicler uses these seemingly super dry lists to actually tell a story. It's almost like a coded message revealing who held the real power.
So right off the bat, the chronicler puts the tribe of Judah front and center, which I thought was kind of curious.
Yeah.
Reuben was technically the oldest son of Jacob.
Right.
So shouldn't he be the star of the show?
Yeah, that's where the chronicler gets clever.
Okay.
He explains how the birthright, that special status reserved for the firstborn, shifted from Reuben to Judah. Reuben, let's just say he made some questionable choices.
Ooh.
And that opened the door for Judah's rise.
So Judah gets the spotlight. And then the chronicler dives into this story about Tamar.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, listeners, is a wild ride.
It is.
Dr. Konkol mentions it briefly.
Yeah.
But you'll definitely want to look that one up.
Absolutely.
Let's just say it involves deception and inheritance rights.
Yeah.
And a whole lot of drama.
A whole lot.
Yeah.
And that's precisely how Judah solidifies his position.
Okay.
The chronicler uses Tamar's story to show how Judah, despite not being the firstborn, becomes the patriarch who sets the stage for David.
It's like he's carefully constructing this foundation.
Yes.
Making sure we understand why Judah is the chosen lineage.
Yeah.
So let's trace that line to David.
Okay.
We've got Tamar,
mm-hmm.
her son Perez,
yeah.
then Hezron, Ram, Jesse, and finally David.
Yes.
But here's where it gets interesting.
Okay.
The chronicler points out that David was the seventh son.
That detail really jumped out at me too.
Yeah.
In the book of Samuel, there's a suggestion that David was the youngest of eight sons.
So why this discrepancy?
Yeah.
Is the chronicler just getting his facts wrong, or is there something more to it?
I don't think it's a simple mistake.
Okay.
We have to consider the literary style of these ancient texts.
Right.
Numbers often hold symbolic meaning in Hebrew writing.
Yeah.
Seven can represent completeness or perfection.
Okay.
And maybe the chronicler is emphasizing a symbolic aspect of David's lineage here.
So it's not just about the literal birth order, but about highlighting a deeper, almost spiritual significance. That's a great point.
Yeah.
And while we're talking about connecting the dots, I noticed the chronicler basically uses the Book of Ruth's genealogy here.
Right.
He's pulling from that.
It's like he's weaving these different narratives together.
Yeah.
Creating this intricate tapestry of interconnectedness.
Yeah.
And by incorporating the Book of Ruth, he's subtly reminding us of the importance of loyalty, faithfulness, and even those who might be considered outsiders. And speaking of interconnectedness, I was struck by the mention of Zeruiah and Abigail.
Yes.
David's aunts.
Right.
They end up being the mothers of some pretty key players in David's story.
Uh-huh.
Joab is top general.
Exactly.
The chronicler doesn't just focus on the male line.
No.
He highlights these powerful women on David's mother's side.
Showing
how David is surrounded by a network of strength and influence even before he takes the throne.
It's like he's subtly suggesting that David's success wasn't just about his own abilities.
Right.
But also about this powerful family he came from.
And then we get to this detail about Hezron, Perez's son.
Yep.
The chronicler mentions that Hezron's daughter married into the tribe of Manasseh.
Yeah.
Now, why is that such a big deal?
This detail reveals a key aspect of David's power base.
Okay.
Manasseh was one of the tribes located east of the Jordan River.
Right.
This means David had family connections on both sides of the Jordan.
Oh, wow.
Not just in the south where Judah was located.
So when David later unites the tribes and calls them all brothers,
right.
It's not just political rhetoric.
Exactly.
He actually has family ties across the land.
He does.
That's incredible.
It adds a whole new dimension to his claim of kingship.
Yeah.
He's not just a conqueror imposing his rule.
Right.
He can legitimately claim kinship with these tribes.
Wow.
And the chronicler is subtly revealing how those connections were established generations earlier.
I love how these seemingly insignificant details
yeah.
suddenly become so crucial when you understand the context.
Yeah.
And speaking of challenging assumptions, there's a story about Shishan, who had no sons, but a daughter who married an Egyptian. An Egyptian in the lineage of Judah.
Yeah.
How is that even possible?
This challenges our modern notions of a purely patriarchal lineage, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
It also subverts any ideas of racial purity that might be associated with the lineage of David.
Right.
The chronicler is telling us that this Egyptian line continued for 20 generations.
Wow. So it wasn't just a fleeting connection.
No.
They were a significant family within the tribe of Judah.
They were.
It makes you wonder how those descendants were viewed and treated.
And it makes you wonder why the chronicler included this detail.
Yeah.
Is he subtly criticizing the tendency towards ethnic exclusion? Or is he showing that even a lineage as significant as David's wasn't as pure as some might imagine?
That's a great point. It's like he's intentionally pushing back against any attempts to present this lineage as exclusive or superior.
Yeah.
It's a reminder that history is messy and complicated.
Right.
And bloodlines aren't always as straightforward as they seem.
Exactly.
And with that thought-provoking point, I think it's time for a break. Stay with us, because when we come back, we'll delve into the story of David's sons.
Right.
And believe me, things get even more interesting.
They do.
So don't go anywhere.
We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. Before the break, we were talking about how the chronicler carefully lays out David's family tree and highlights this intriguing connection to Egypt within the tribe of Judah.
It's mind-blowing to think about how interconnected these ancient families were.
Right.
And how a seemingly minor detail can suddenly, like, illuminate a whole new perspective on history.
Yeah.
But let's move on to David's sons.
Okay.
The chronicler specifically mentions those born in Hebron.
Uh-huh.
And then points out Solomon's birth in Jerusalem.
That's a deliberate move by the chronicler.
Okay.
He's emphasizing the transition of power from Hebron, where David was first anointed king, to Jerusalem, which becomes the capital of the United Kingdom under David's rule.
So Solomon's birth in Jerusalem is like a symbolic marker.
Exactly.
Showing the establishment of this new era.
And remember, the chronicler is all about tracing the lineage that leads to the kings of Judah.
Right.
Solomon, as the son who inherits the throne, becomes crucial to that narrative.
And then it feels like we're suddenly fast-forwarding through time.
Right.
The chronicler breezes through a list of kings all the way to the exile.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Why this sudden jump?
The chronicler provides a concise overview of this period, almost like he's giving us the Spark Notes version, hitting the highlights of the Davidic dynasty.
So what do you think he's emphasizing and what is he leaving out?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
That's a possibility.
Yeah.
Or perhaps he's assuming his audience is already familiar with the broad strokes of this history.
Right.
And wants to draw their attention to specific details that might have been overlooked.
Either way, it's a stark contrast to the meticulous detail he gives to the earlier generations.
Yes.
And then, boom, things get chaotic with Josiah's sons.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a royal soap opera erupts.
It really does.
We have Jehoahaz, who's appointed king. Then the Egyptians step in and put his brother Eliakim on the throne.
Wow.
Renaming him Jehoiakim.
It's a fascinating case study in the dangers of succession crises.
Yeah.
Josiah's death creates this power vacuum. And both internal factions and external forces like the Egyptians try to manipulate the situation to their advantage.
And just when you think you've got it figured out, Jehoiakim's son Jehoiachin takes the throne.
Oh, geez.
But then gets exiled. Wait, wasn't Jehoiakim Josiah's son?
Yeah.
So now we're dealing with a grandson.
Yes, it gets complicated.
Okay.
And to add another layer of complexity.
Oh, goodness.
Another of Josiah's sons, Mataniah.
Okay.
Becomes king after Jehoiachin is exiled.
Uh-huh.
But his name is changed to Zedekiah.
So we have Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah, all sons of Josiah.
It's a lot.
Caught in this whirlwind of power struggles, name changes, and exile, I have to admit, it's a bit hard to keep track of all these Jehoses.
It does require some mental gymnastics.
It really does.
But the chronicler isn't just trying to confuse us.
Right.
He's highlighting the turmoil and instability that mark this period in Judah's history.
It's a reminder that leadership transitions are rarely smooth.
Right.
Especially when external forces are vying for control. And maybe the chronicler is drawing a parallel between the chaos of Josiah's sons and the eventual downfall of the kingdom.
That's a great insight.
Yeah.
The chronicler is a master of subtly weaving together these seemingly disparate threads to create a larger narrative about the rise and fall of the Davidic dynasty.
It's like he's saying, look, even the most powerful lineage isn't immune to internal strife and external pressures.
Exactly.
And speaking of external pressures, I can't help but think back to that Egyptian lineage within the tribe of Judah.
Interesting connection.
Yeah.
We talked about how that detail challenges traditional notions of lineage.
Right.
And perhaps even critiques notions of racial purity.
Now, as we see the Egyptians exerting their influence on the throne,
yeah,
it makes you wonder if the chronicler is drawing a subtle connection between those two events.
Hmm. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Are those ancient family ties playing a role in the political dynamics of this period?
That's possible.
Is the chronicler subtly suggesting that the seeds of Judah's downfall were sown generations earlier?
That's a fascinating question.
Yeah.
It shows how these genealogicalists aren't just dry recitations of names and dates.
Right.
They offer glimpses into complex relationships, political maneuvering,
yeah,
and the long shadow of history.
It's like we're piecing together a puzzle.
Uh-huh.
And every detail, no matter how small, can reveal a new pattern or connection.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with that thought, I think it's time to take another pause.
Okay.
When we come back, we'll explore what all of this means and what the chronicler is ultimately trying to tell us. Welcome back, everyone. We've been on quite a journey through the Book of Chronicles, tracing the lineage of David, uncovering hidden power dynamics, and even grappling with those confusing J-hosts.
Yeah, it's amazing how these genealogies, which can seem so tedious at first glance, suddenly come alive when you start to understand the context.
Right, it's like we've been digging through these layers of history, and now we're finally getting to the treasure buried beneath. But what is that treasure? What is the chronicler ultimately trying to tell us?
I think one of the key takeaways is this idea of a different kind of power base for David.
Yeah.
We often focus on his military victories, his image as this, like, warrior king, but the chronicler is showing us a different side of the story.
Yeah, we've talked about how David wasn't just some lone hero who conquered his way to the top.
Uh-huh.
He had this incredible network of family connections strategically spread across both sides of the Jordan River.
Right.
But how did that translate into actual power?
Think of it this way. These family ties weren't just about bloodlines.
Okay.
They represented alliances, loyalties, and obligations.
Mm-hmm.
It was a web of interconnectedness that extended far beyond the battlefield.
So it wasn't just about brute force.
Right.
It was about influence diplomacy and, like, leveraging those relationships to solidify his position.
Exactly. The chronicler is showing us a David who is not only a skilled warrior, but also a shrewd strategist, a master of building and maintaining alliances.
And it makes you wonder, how much of David's success was due to these carefully cultivated family connections?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Were those bloodlines just as important as battlefield prowess?
That's a thought-provoking question, isn't it? It challenges us to reconsider traditional notions of power and leadership.
Yeah.
Maybe the chronicler is subtly suggesting that the seeds of a successful kingdom are sown not just on the battlefield, but also in the intricate tapestry of relationships that bind a society together.
It's like those genealogical lists are revealing this hidden dimension of David's story.
Right.
A story that goes beyond the epic battles and heroic feats. It's a story about political, savvy, strategic alliances and the enduring power of family ties.
And maybe that's the brilliance of the chronicler. He's inviting us to look beyond the surface, to delve into the complexities of history, and to discover the often overlooked factors that shape the course of events. He's showing us that power isn't just about who can wield the biggest sword, but also about who can build the strongest network of alliances and loyalties.
It's a lesson that resonates even today. We often think of power in terms of military might or economic dominance. But the chronicler is reminding us that true power, lasting power, often rests on the strength of relationships, the ability to forge connections, and the wisdom to leverage those connections for the greater good.
It's a powerful message, and it's one that we can all learn from.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the next time you encounter a biblical genealogy, don't just skim over. Take a moment to dig deeper, to explore the hidden stories within those names and lineages. You might be surprised at what you discover.
And remember, history is never just about facts and dates. It's about the stories we tell, the connections we make, and the lessons we learn from those who came before us.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Book of Chronicles. We hope you've enjoyed exploring the world of biblical genealogies and uncovering the hidden power dynamics that shaped the course of history. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep those brains buzzing.